Podcast.
Listen to The Organist, the culturally omnivorous, intellectually ravenous podcast from the editors of The Believer magazine.
Part of poetry is learning how to speak.
Chilly Billy, Chilly Billy.
I am also a horse.
I really value my life, even though I know it's debatable whether I'm even really alive.
The right reading for this is the one I'm giving you.
Find The Organist on KCRW.com or wherever you download podcasts.
From the Independent Producer Project and KCRW.com, I'm Bob Carlson, and this is Unfictional. It's a program of true stories and personal documentaries. And on this episode, Crack Up, three stories about reaching the breaking point. First, the story of Davis. That's not his real name, and you'll understand why in a minute. He got himself a real job at a real accounting firm that pays him lots and lots of real money. But that's also how he ended up drunk and alone at his office late one night, standing in the middle of a pile of office supplies and equipment he just smashed to the ground. From KCRW.com, it's Unfictional.
So accounting firms always hire people before their busy time, which is typically right after year end. So I was one of the interns that they brought on. I was really excited when I got the internship, and then pretty quickly upon starting work, it seemed like I didn't belong there, I didn't fit in there. I grew up in the city, grew up lower middle class, and the whole like white collar world is a whole different world. When your boss talks about having five houses, that like f***ed me up right away. I was really disgusted by the richness. It just seemed bizarre to be getting paid so much. People I grew up with will probably never have that. They gave me a week of free lunch that I could expense to the company. And so what I would do is I would go get these like $10 or $11 lunches and then write in the tip for like $14. So I just thought it was a matter of time until I was out of there. I came in at 8 on a Saturday morning. I was doing more lonely computer work, dealing with people who I thought were really slimy. I was near my wit's end, or I was like, okay, I'm just going to run out of here and never come back, when one of my coworkers kind of forced me into having drinks. I didn't really want to do because I didn't really like my coworkers that much. We went out downtown, and I remember being at really nice bars, like one that had a waterfall in it, a place where they come over and make the guacamole in front of you on the side of the table, and it costs like $27 for guacamole. But it was nice. I was bonding with people. I was having a good time for the first time, and I got really drunk. They were going to another bar, and I was going to meet up with my friends. All my stuff I had left back at the office, so I went back up to it. I swipe in, and I'm alone in the office for the first time and drunk in the office for the first time. And I was standing there for a while just looking at my computer screen and kind of looking around the office. Then I was like, oh, f*** it, this is it. I can totally just stop this right now. I picked up my computer monitor, and I just threw it away from me, kind of out of my cube, and it went as far as the cord would go. And then kind of snapped back and came on the ground. And that was just the start of it. And then I started going from cube to cube and just throwing up papers and throwing over chairs and throwing down computer screens. It was just pure adrenaline rush. Like, I don't think I've maybe ever had that much adrenaline just flowing through. It only lasted a minute, and then being like, oh, I really got to get out of here. Like, go, go, go. Like 30 plus stories up, I hit the elevator button and I really had to pee. I could have waited, but it just kind of furthered the destruction. Like, oh, this is the last thing, and peed in the elevator. Elevator doors open. There's a receptionist person there 24 hours. And he just says his normal, like, have a good night. And I'm like, okay, have a good night. I went to the station, I was waiting for the train, and there were three kids there, like high school kids. When I saw them, I was like, oh, they're up to some like hustle, or they're gonna like go do something, and that reminded me of me at that age. I asked them and found out that they went to the same high school in the city that I went to. It was kind of like looking into the past. I'm sure I was a drunk mess. I was like telling them like, oh, I have this job. I didn't tell them I just trashed the office, but I was like, oh, I have this like grown-up job now. Like, ha ha ha. It's so weird. I also proceeded at the end to just give them all the cash that was in my wallet from all this money I had from my new job. It was like $200 and $300 that I just gave the kid. Like, okay, have a good night. I remember waking up and being really dehydrated and hungover. I thought there were two possibilities, like, A, I'm going to get arrested for destroying the office and, like, go to jail, or that I would get fired, which also sounded horrible in a different way. That Monday morning, I was still ridden with anxiety, like, I shouldn't go to the office, I guess I have to go to the office, it'll be better. I think I got there ridiculously early, like, maybe at, like, 7:15 or so, and then I rode the elevator up, not the P elevator, but one of the other elevators. Went in and I didn't see anybody right away until I turned the corner, and it was just two of my coworkers there picking up papers on the ground. And I just tried to like act like shocked, and I was like looking around like, oh, who did this? And then we just kind of looked at each other like, I don't know. Within an hour, there were no signs of destruction. Papers were back on the desk. Someone had picked up the computer monitors. And then I started working really nervously all day, but I'm like so distracted that I'm not doing anything right. Just sitting at my desk, kind of like nervously playing on my keyboard. And then around like 3 or 4 o'clock, one of my bosses was like, do you have time at the end of the day? We need you to step into Dave's office for a project. And I walk in and have a seat, like, how am I gonna respond to this? Am I just gonna fess up? But they just started talking right away. Prank wars started earlier this year. Marketing department got us good. This usually doesn't happen until the heat of busy season. What the f*** are they talking about? So I guess there just had been prank wars in the past, like interdepartmental people screwing with each other. And I realized like, oh man, they think it's someone else who did it. So we proceeded to wait until the boss of the marketing department left. And then my coworker and Dave and I just kind of snuck into his office and closed the door and like just turned the whole thing upside down. Like from pictures on the wall to things like inside desk drawers to like prying out keys on a keyboard and just flipping them upside down. And like the computer screen was upside down. We took like an hour just turning stuff upside down. That ended up factoring into overtime, so I got paid overtime for that. In the weeks following, I definitely worked harder. I developed more of a sense of autonomy. I think things stopped bothering me, just mostly because I did that and got away with it. It made it into like a fun, sneaky game. And I still work at the company today. Trashing the office was the best thing for my career, yeah.
That story was produced by Lila Cherniff, a freelance radio producer and fellow at American Public Media. You're listening to Unfictional on KCRW.com. I'm Bob Carlson, and today on the program, Crack Up, stories from the breaking point. And next, a man on a desert island of his own making, an emotional desert island. But then Brian meets the person that makes him want to rejoin civilization, as long as it doesn't drive him insane. And a warning that there are mentions of sex in the story, but no foul language. From KCRW.com, it's Unfictional.
I was in Whole Foods when I had my first panic attack. I was there because my wife Jean had decided that we should only eat cage-free organic meat. And now I was at the checkout buying chicken that had presumably expired of natural causes in a poultry hospice or something when I started to feel off. My heart was racing and my face was sweating and then the sharp pain in my chest and boom, I just like fell to the floor, passed out. And then I was 100% sure, positive that I was dying. The weird thing was that I actually didn't want to. For once, and this new found hopefulness, once again, for that, I blame Jean. Now, the first time I saw her, 5 years before the panic attack, I just knew. which is weird since on paper, we could not be more opposite. Gene is the happiest person who's ever been alive, ever. And I've always thought of happiness as a form of weakness, right? People who smile in pictures are idiots. One morning, when we first started dating, I woke up, and before I even opened my eyes, the very first thing I said was, "It's better to never have been born." Which is something I said often, but I said it right away, the first thing when I woke up. And of course, Gene's response was, "I don't understand how you could say you wished you were dead." And I explained, I didn't say I wish I was dead. I mean, I do sometimes, but I didn't tell her that. I said, what I meant was that maybe for me and for, well, a lot of people, it might have been better if I was never born in the first place. And she laughed. And it was one of those great laughs where she didn't want to. It's just sort of like a reluctant laugh, which in my mind means I won the conversation. A few days later, and I was back in that negative space again, right? Only now it was late afternoon and I came home and Gene asked me, how was your day? A typical, normal question. And I responded, I was just in that mindset, and I just started ranting about the traffic on Los Feliz Boulevard because the people with the BMWs and CNN and people who talked during the movies because the night before we had a movies and how and wealth inequality in LA and how some people have so much and how annoying it is. And or like people we know on social media start about how they just brag. And it's like, oh, you know what? When you're starting off and you want to tell people you're doing well, great. But if you're doing well for a long period of time and you keep posting about it, that's just obnoxious. And I was like just about to launch into gluten-free foods or something when I looked at Gene and I could just see just a little bit of the love leave her eyes. And so I immediately stopped talking, and eventually I learned how to screw that valve on top of my head that keeps all the negative thoughts in and just keep it shut and try to keep the crazy to myself as best I could. And despite our differences, those first couple months, we fit perfectly, like a glove. We made each other laugh every single day, and I've never been happier. But, you know, after 4 or 5 months, that impulse to disappear was strong. For me, like 4, 5, 6 months tops is usually when I cut and run. And I thought it was because I like being alone, which I do. It's why I love that movie, Castaway, or at least the first two-thirds. Tom Hanks is on the island. He like, you know, it's hard at first, but then eventually he learns to like deal with things and he learns to fish and he grows that cool beard and he just sort of relaxes and he's alone with his own thoughts. And to me, that's the best part of the movie. It's only after he leaves the island and goes back to society, that's when his heart breaks. And I always told myself, the key is to stay on the island, you know? But when I met Gene, I wanted off. I wanted to be rescued. And it was a surprisingly like nice revelation, but also, you know, that's when things got weird. Specifically sex, and I know it's weird when middle-aged guys talk about sex, but suddenly I stopped wanting it, you know? I just didn't want to have sex, or I physically couldn't, you know? At first, Jean thought maybe I was gay, and then she thought maybe something horrible happened when I was a kid, like I was molested. You know, I humored her diagnoses, I watched some gay porn, but meh, didn't really do it for me. And I actually had some awkward conversations with my dad and some family members, and I don't think I was molested. The truth is, deep down, like, I knew what my problem was. My issue with affection, besides the fact that I call it affection, you know, it's been perpetuated by a 20-year cycle, right? So I meet some lady, I have drunk fun times, it gets, you know, real, and then I end it. And then I'd be alone for a few months. Then I'd meet somebody else, we'd have a good time, and then it would start to get real, and I would end it. And I would do this every year for my whole life. Half the year I'd be dating somebody, and the other half I'd be alone. And I think, in that time, I'd go long stretches alone, I may have inadvertently become addicted to porn. Like, you know, maybe after spending too much time alone engaging with 5-minute videos on my laptop, I'd become unable to participate in emotional interactions, you know, like a sociopath, like Dahmer. And this led me to avoid relationships based on mutual respect. So love, that one thing that most people cultivate as an escape from this life of horror, is the one thing that I had somehow and maybe even intentionally avoided. Wonderful, good for me. So soon after Gene and I moved in together, we started going to therapy. Our therapist, Florence, told me that I needed to relax. She would just be like, hey, you just need to relax. Also, that I probably needed to go cold turkey from the internets for a while, so I chilled out and stopped watching porn. And right after that, Florence broke up with us. She said, hey, look, you guys, you're okay. She made a point to say, like, you're not okay to me, but you guys as a couple, you're okay. But still, in my mind, that means I won therapy. Then it was like magic. Gene and I talked like human beings. We had good times. We had good sex. And we got married. It was a perfect day. There's not much of a story in that part because the good times, there's no drama. It was just good, but not really a story. But I felt great. I had finally joined the normal people, you know? I was ready for the happily ever after part. A few weekends later, some friends of ours came over with their 2-year-old kid who pushed our TV, literally pushed the TV over, and threw grapes at the wall, while his parents, who said nothing, ran around cleaning up after him. After they left, Gene and I joked that, look, if we have kids, we're not going to be weird LA parents like our friends who never say the word no or can't. Like, we laughed, deciding we'd only say no or can't to our kid. No, can't, no, can't. We decided we would raise our kids, if we had them, the way we were raised, with discipline and shame. Before long, you know, that joking sort of became a conversation, and Gene mentioned that, you know, if we did, she wanted to have a home birth. But again, we were way ahead of ourselves, because I started wondering, you know, could we even make a baby? Maybe our parts don't work so good. We were old. So we struck a deal. Look, if we couldn't, if it didn't work, we weren't going to try any sort of like extra special measures. We weren't going to do IVF or any of that stuff. We have so many friends who did it, and it seems hard and expensive, and it becomes their lives. And we thought, look, if our baby makers were broken, we would be the people who travel. You know, I'd like to go to Abu Dhabi someday. But unbelievably, the very first time we tried without birth control, magic, Jean got pregnant. Unbelievable. And the day after she peed on the stick and we found out was the day that I was at Whole Foods buying overpriced chicken. And my anxiety started when I realized that I had left my wallet at home. I told the cashier, Tina, hey, look, I live a mile away. I got my wallet, you know, is back at home. I'm gonna go grab it. Can you just hold on to my meat while I leave? Only I laughed when I said, hold my meat, because I'm emotionally a 12-year-old boy. And Tina says she has to get the manager, Steve, to get permission. I'm like, there's what? Permission? Just hold. Fine, I'm just going to leave. I'll come back. Before you know it, Steve comes over and is like, what's the problem? And I'm like, what's the problem? Well, Steve, the problem is that I need to relax, you know? But how can I relax, Florence, when my wife is pregnant? She's pregnant, Steve. We hadn't even told our parents yet at that point, so the first people I actually told that my wife was pregnant was Steve and Tina at Whole Foods. Then Steve, the least Jewish man in the world, says, Mazel Tov. And I laughed. Now I had unscrewed the valve all the way up my head. I don't know, Steve. I don't know if it's Mazel Tov. I've always felt that it's better than ever been born. I feel that's especially true for the poor schmuck who's going to be my kid. I mean, Jean, she'd be an amazing mom. She's smart and she's kind and she's patient. She's artistic. But me, Steve, I think I might be insane. What if I don't love it enough? Do you know how expensive schools are in LA, Steve? Do you know that? What if my kid gets bullied or is like me and all anxious? What if he's stupid or she's a jerk or he's a terrorist or she's a Republican or a vegan or a serial killer? Part of me hopes maybe, I mean, I don't know, maybe because we're old. Part of me hopes that maybe Jean will have a miscarriage. As soon as I said that, I knew that that wasn't true, that I didn't hope that she had a miscarriage. And I also knew it was horrible, you know, to say. I mean, to think, but let alone to say out loud. And I could look at Steve and Tina and I just, you know, their faces, I could tell that they were like, oh, man, dude, you're insane, which, you know, fair enough. And then suddenly I had that feeling, you know, my heart started racing and my face was sweating and then that sharp pain and boom, I went down. When I opened my eyes and I was on the floor, I looked up and I could see Steve, you know, and he was saying something about calling 911. I was like, hey, look, don't. I think I'm just having a panic attack. And then Tina's like, have you had one before? And I was like, no, I haven't, but I kind of knew I would eventually. I mean, I knew it was coming at some point. And then I screwed that valve back in my head and I went home to Jean. And when I walked in, she smiled and she said, how was your day? And I lied and I said, it was great. And for the next 3 months, we did what all the books say you do, right? We kept quiet. We didn't tell anyone, didn't jinx it. Then finally, after 3 months, we were ready. Flew to New York. We saw both of our families at this big meal at an Italian restaurant. It was great. Everyone was so happy for us. I collected the check. And of course, I don't think my brother put in the full amount of money, so I had to put in extra money. But other than that, great. We were super happy. And then same night, we got back from New York. We flew in late. We went to sleep. And about an hour or two later, Jean said, I think something's happening. And we were jet-lagged and tired, and we went to this hospital and everything. I was so worried about Jean. She didn't look well. And by the time the doctor said the word miscarriage, it was like I was sucker punched, you know? And then we drove home, just sort of weighed down with that crippling grief. Over the next 4 years, there were 5 more miscarriages and 3 failed IVF attempts. And this is the part of the story, you know, where the person usually says, then one night we got drunk and without trying or planning or using apps on our phone or masturbating into a Dixie cup in, you know, a fertility center in Pasadena, it all happened. Bam, she got pregnant. We got babies. We got twins. But this isn't that story. We don't have a baby. We can't make one that way. It's not going to happen. Ever. And it's hard, you know. It's hard to see everyone we know on Instagram on the weekends with their kids. It's hard when we get those emails to bring food to our friends who just brought their newborns home, or see my dad on Facebook so happy as he holds my sister's kid and writes proud grandfather as his Facebook status. And it's even harder for Jean, whose dad died this year. And now it would be easy for me to say that it's better to never have been born. It would be so easy for me to joke and say, I'd wish I was still on that island with that volleyball, and I do love that movie, and I do think it's terrible when he gets off. But that's not my story anymore either. Because that night after the first miscarriage, as I helped Jean into her bed, exhausted and sad, I knew. I knew that night in the hospital that Jean's happiness isn't weakness. She is stronger than I will ever be. It's me. It's that misanthropic, pessimistic, bitter, hostile, negative BS. That's weakness. And I still know it. And I know that although I have a hard time with everything, I know that we can get through anything. Which, in my mind, means we won marriage.
Brian Finkelstein is a writer and comedian living in Los Angeles. You're listening to Unfictional from KCRW.com. I'm Bob Carlson, and on today's program, Crack Up. And finally, a story about silence. Shaz Bennett doesn't like it, and she always tries to find a way to fill it. And sometimes she fills it with the noise and chaos of talk radio. And one time, she decided to dive headfirst into the noise, call into the show, and become a part of the chaos. From KCRW.com, it's Unfictional.
I have a very complicated relationship with silence. In general, I don't like it. I grew up in a house full of people, 4 brothers, 1 sister, 2 parents, 2 dogs, 7 cats, numerous gerbils. My dad always had talk radio on in the background, so there was always voices in my house, always. One of the few times I ever remember being silent and alone, I was 13 or something, and I was really, really alone. Everybody was out doing something without me. I went through the whole house, turning on all the lights because, you know, maybe someone somewhere would look up and see me in this house all alone and know that I was there. I was so small. I was replaceable. So I went to the stereo. I turned on the talk radio really, really loud. Trying to fill the house with voices.
You denied that the polls weren't accurate. They were your polls, and I won them.
No, they weren't a poll. What it was people calling in. And anybody.
Even all the lights on, I still didn't feel better. So I turned on the TV, all the clock radios, and sat in the living room and just looked out over the sea of lights that made up my little city in Utah, knowing that in every one of those lights, there was somebody there. And then the power went out. And the silence surrounded me, enveloped me. I was alone, it was dark, and the silence was deafening. And right then, when I had given up all hope, my parents walked in the door. And I was so happy to see them, and I followed my mother to get candles, and we were running around the house, and then the power came back on. And the lights were just so brilliant, and the sound was visceral. It shot through my chest, and I ran outside to see the house all lit up. My parents were home. It was light and loud, and I was alive. When I came back in, my mom was turning out the lights, and it was the 70s, and my dad was complaining and ranting about we had to conserve energy. And neither of them asked me why I had turned on all the lights in the house. And I thought, they must think I'm like this all the time. Maybe I am. I love the sound of voices and talk. I have it on all the time, podcasting in my ears all the time. I don't listen to call-in shows anymore. And I definitely don't call in when I listen. I mean, that'd be crazy, right? Once upon a time, I was listening to a call-in show, Jay Diamond, on WABC.
And now, Jay Diamond.
And for some reason, I was compelled to pick up the phone and call in. The screener asks me what it is I want to talk about, and I hadn't thought about it. So I say, well, I guess I just want to talk about what an idiot Jay Diamond is. And the screener says, aha, you're next.
And Shaz, this is Jay Diamond, hi.
Hey Jay, this is Shaz Bennett calling from New York City, Manhattan.
Never give out your last name on a talk radio show in New York City, FYI.
Shaz Bennett?
Yes, that's me.
Pleased to meet you, Shaz.
Nice to meet you.
I don't go right into the whole, you're an idiot, Jay. I ask him if he's ever seen any of Nanny Moretti's films. He's a bit like the Italian Woody Allen.
One of the first sections about this guy, basically, is dying of cancer. It's very sad, but the first section...
I start to tell him how in one of his films, Caro Diario, there's a radio personality on his deathbed who feels compelled to apologize to everyone he's harmed in his lifetime, which is a lot of people. And he's begging for forgiveness of his public, and it's very dark and very funny. And I say, you really should see it, Jay. I'm sure it would hit you in ways you ought to be hit.
Do you feel any remorse for your paranoia?
Were you asking me?
Yeah.
Oh, you're asking me that question?
Yeah, I'm asking you.
Do I feel
applicable to you?
Oh. Do I feel any remorse, paranoia, what else?
And your sensationalist way of dealing with this world.
And I'm not upset. I'm very calm, and he's getting annoyed. So he says, what is your point, Shaz?
I listen to a lot of what you say. A lot of it makes sense. A lot of it doesn't make any sense at all.
Why are you spreading this paranoia and fear? Your premise is...
That's what you're spreading, fear.
What are you on, Shaz?
I must be on drugs or something because I spend money to see foreign films. And he starts to describe the type of person I am. I must hang out in a coffee shop at the Angelica Film Center and talk about art and foreign films, which I am, but I'm not sure why he's saying this like it's a bad thing. So he says, "What are you on, Shaz?" I say, "Nothing. I'm from Salt Lake City, Utah. I'm a Mormon." I am, technically.
"Can you tell me about the angel Moroni?"
"Moroni."
"Well, this is back east. I want to see if you're really a Mormon."
Moroni is the man depicted in all the gold statues on top of all the Mormon temples. You know, on Santa Monica Boulevard, that statue will come to life and blow the golden horn to signal the second coming. So look up and pay attention if that should ever happen. I just remember thinking, he doesn't even know what he's talking about. He has his own radio show. He talks for a living. He doesn't know what he's talking about, but it doesn't stop him from talking. And then I thought, maybe all these people listening to his show in the dark are thinking to themselves, he doesn't know what he's talking about. But no one is going to say anything because they don't want to appear like they don't know what it all means, like the emperor's new clothes. They'll just lead one another further and further away from anything rational, right? Talking and words will become obsolete and we'll have no way of communicating with one another. Talking is a very limited form of communication, but it's all we have.
The truth is that I'm not on anything. You implied I was on drugs, so I'm telling you.
Shut up!
Not.
And then I hear Jay Diamond screaming at me on the phone because I wasn't really paying attention.
"Excuse me, don't ever tell me to shut up, okay?"
He says, "I hate you, Shaz. I mean it. I really do."
I can't talk to you. I just cannot. And
why?
I'm going to tell him not to take your
phone. Why can't you do that?
Well, because I hate your sniveling guts, for one reason. And number two, because you don't let me speak. Number three, because your premise is mistaken.
I'm listening.
I do not
to
see
you.
The world in a simple black and white way. I see the world in a complicated way, and I think that I make that clear every night on the air. And I object to the fact that you're trying to inculcate a people. All right, that's enough. No, I really, listen to me. I really mean that. I really do hate your guts. Because DC, let's say hi to Betty. Hello, Betty.
Hello. That conversation was a little difficult.
No, well, she has a severe mental disorder.
And after he hung up on me, they kept talking about, all the regulars would call back and they keep talking about me.
"Listen, you can do me a favor with this Mormon girl. Can you tell her one more time to shut up? Because she sounded like she was threatening you. Don't you dare tell me to shut up. Please, please say shut up."
Well, it was, yeah, I did that for a reason, because I wanted to overpower her.
And then a couple of his listeners started calling me. My phone started ringing. Never give out your last name on the radio. When I was very young, I went to a powwow with my mother in Utah. And after the powwow, we drove far out in the desert and we set up our camp. And I was really hyped up on powdered sugar and fry bed carbs and just kept talking and talking and talking and talking. And my mom was trying to calm me down. And she says, "Shaz, shh, Shaz, just look up." And I look up and the stars were overwhelming and the silence was deafening. And I was so tiny and I leaned back into my mother. And she wrapped her arms around me. And I felt safe in the quiet. Like I said, I have a complicated relationship with silence.
Shaz Bennett is a writer, director, storyteller, and many other things. She's finishing up her first feature film called Alaska is a Drag. You can find links, information, and photos about this episode at our website, kcrw.com/unfictional. I'm Bob Carlson, producer of Unfictional. The editor is Nick White. The associate producer is Carla Green. Podcast the show on iTunes, follow the show on Twitter @Unfictional, or like us on Facebook, please. But most importantly, I hope you'll join me next time for Unfictional from KCRW.com.